From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week, we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Last week, I started the show doing something I really don't like to do, by urging you to give us money. But listener support is an essential part of keeping State of Belief on the air, and so I want to say thank you to those of you who responded to that appeal, and to urge the rest of you to visit stateofbelief.com and make a donation today. We produce this show on a remarkably tight budget. The conversations you hear every week are broadcast on radio stations, downloaded via podcast, and posted online for easy access by anyone, anywhere. There are no premium memberships, and there are no deep pockets. So we need to count on you. And right now is when we need you the most, so we can ensure this show continues and that the show continues to grow. So please, please visit stateofbelief.com today and send what you can along to us. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Texas Republicans recently endorsed a therapy that purports to turn gay people straight. Keep it honest, there's really no scientific evidence it works and plenty of reason to believe that it's actually harmful.
Every one of us makes decisions we're not proud of. God loves each one of us, and he offers a way for us to deal with sin and with bad choices.
Even as California and New Jersey have succumbed to science and banned so-called ex-gay therapy for minors, the Texas GOP this past weekend enshrined endorsement of the practice in their party platform. Peter Montgomery of People for the American Way will be here to examine what that portends for the coming midterm elections.
The Identify and Deport group in our survey on the immigration question also wants just the U.S. to mind its own business. Internationally, the Path to Citizenship group is much more internationalist or pro-engagement.
The respected Public Religion Research Institute, together with the nonpartisan Brookings Institution, has just released the results of a wide-ranging new survey on American attitudes toward immigration reform. And it's immediately evident that the rhetoric coming out of parts of Washington does not reflect the will of the people on this issue. While that may be less than surprising, considering recent congressional history, there's plenty in the survey titled What Americans Want from Immigration Reform 2014 that'll raise eyebrows. And PRRI has another new survey out with plenty of insights into American views on religious liberty as expressed in current battles over the contraception coverage mandate, workplace discrimination, and marriage equality. We'll delve into the findings of both surveys when PRRI CEO Dr. Robert P. Jones joins us later on this week's show. But first,
the decisions that they make, the words that they say, the ideas that they tolerate in society are literally costing human lives. I'm Nate Phelps, and I'm not my father's son.
Earlier this year, we talked about the transition facing the notorious Westboro Baptist Church after the death of founder Fred Phelps Sr. An early defector was Nate Phelps, the sixth of Fred Phelps' 13 children, who first left Westboro in 1976 and permanently severed ties 4 years later, hoping that his story of growing up in a world of violence and control may be helpful to others trapped in similar situations. Nate Phelps has agreed to do a documentary film of his life titled Not My Father's Son, One Man's Journey from Hate to Hope. Right now, the filmmakers are urgently raising funds for the project already underway at the crowdsourcing website Kickstarter with a goal of $55,000 and a deadline of July 7th. We'll put the link up on our website. And now, here is part one of my interview with Westboro Baptist Church survivor, Nate Phelps. Nate, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Was it a difficult decision to agree to do a full-length documentary about your life?
I'll be honest with you. I think that the difficulty was the decision I made about 5 years ago when I was confronted with the opportunity to actually start speaking publicly about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to confront a lot of the fear that I still had, a lot of the guilt. So I went through a deliberate process then before I started speaking and made up my mind that I was prepared to deal with whatever. So since then, no, this is what I decided that I was going to do. One of the decisions I made was, to the best of my ability, I was going to be as transparent and as honest as I could be, even mm-hmm. about the ugly stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly, in the process, raises up a lot of ugliness, a lot
sure.
of emotions.
Sure.
But I'm more than prepared and willing to do that right now.
Nate, I think there are a lot of people who like to think of Westboro as a pretty unique organization. But you focus on the family dynamics, as I understand it, and that's why you believe there are many, many others yes. who are harmed in the name of religion during their formative years. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. First of all, I think it is a misdiagnosis if people think that the Westboro Baptist Church is that far from a lot of other religious groups in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the fact that they were so in your face about it is off-putting. But there are a lot of people out there who secretly hold basically mm-hmm. the exact same ideas that they do.
Yeah.
And that translates to a rigidness and an intolerance in the life of a child growing up in an environment like that. It is profoundly destructive.
Mm-hmm. What was it like growing up in the Westboro Baptist Church?
First thing you have to understand is the nature of my father. He wasn't just this preacher who was espousing a fundamentalist Calvinist ideology. He was a driven man. He was a intelligent man. And he was extreme in everything he did. He was very black and white.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start taking some of these Bible verses and interpreting them black and white, you start seeing behavior patterns come out, such mm-hmm. as his willingness to use physical violence to maintain order in the house. So he also took from the Bible that he had the right and the authority and the responsibility to keep his wife in subjection. So he was violent towards her, physically and verbally.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the nature of the environment we grew up in, was this extreme, critical, often enough violent that it kept everyone on their toes. And that's an aspect of it that most people don't understand, is you didn't have to have violence every day. You just had to have an environment where you just never knew.
Mm-hmm.
It was unpredictable when he was going to explode and that was going to spew out to everybody in that environment. So we were constantly afraid. I became a master at reading the environment everywhere I went
yeah.
to see if I was in danger. And I suspect that that's a common thread throughout my siblings, but I don't know that for all of them because I haven't talked to them for 35 years.
Nate, did you see that first in the church or at home?
There was no real distinction between the two. Uh-huh. We lived in the building that the church was in. There were no boundaries. So he would discipline us as quickly from the pulpit as he did in our private lives.
Uh-huh.
He would talk about the conduct of the children or his wife or any other member of, you know, the other few members of the church in front of the rest of the congregation. So it was all the same to me.
Hmm. So were the members of the church in as much fear as you and the other members of the family?
There were two other families that were going there.
I see.
They certainly were in fear of whether they were going to violate one of his ideas about proper conduct.
Mm-hmm.
He had absolute power in that situation, even though he called a couple of the older men elders, they really didn't have any say or control in the situation. So there had to be some level of fear there. I don't think there was fear of physical violence amongst them, but certainly with the rest of my family there was.
So the physical violence was kept within the family, not within the congregation?
Yes and no. I tell the story of why my older brother ended up leaving, because his girlfriend at the time came in for church service one Sunday evening, and my father was upstairs beating my older sister, and the other families were already there, and we were all milling around in the church auditorium waiting for that to finish so church service would start. So they knew it was going on. They just didn't necessarily fear it for themselves.
Yeah. When did you first realize that your life was different from the lives of other kids and that your church was different from other churches?
That's a good question. There's a lot of pieces that play into that. I mean, we grew up with the idea that we were supposed to be different and that difference made us better.
Mm-hmm.
That was the message we were taught. We basically recognized that as being the truth until, you know, we had the capacity to think for ourselves. So I would say that very early on, there was that knowledge that we were different from everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw it as a positive thing,
yeah.
You know, growing up in that situation, that
yeah.
that put us in a better position than the rest of the world.
Were the periods of anger from your father evoked by behavior or by belief or by both?
It was often a combination of things, and it led to overreactions because he would see the conduct of a child that, you know, I mean, I raised four of my own kids, and I'm aware of what kids are capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware of what I did. And instead of it being discipline that matched conduct, he always added so much into it that this was a reflection on the church, and it took on an eternal tone to it that this misconduct of a 5 or 6 year old kid was something that was going to reverberate down the halls of eternity, and it suggested some satanic influence in our lives and that kind of thing. So the reaction was extreme, and the rhetoric was extreme.
Yeah.
And you may realize, and most folks should realize, the physical part of it, that eventually goes away. It's the message that you heard over and over, and the tone in which you heard it. That's what stays with you, and that's where the real destruction comes from.
Did you have questions that you wanted to ask but didn't ask, or could you ask questions at all?
No, you couldn't ask, and I do recall as I moved into my teenage years, a lot of questions coming up. But the problem was that if you showed any inclination to challenge or to do anything other than just accept and embrace wholeheartedly everything that was put out there, it could lead to, at the very least, a lot of verbal abuse so much as challenges, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, as a child, it's very difficult for you to separate out that, you know, this is a process of communicating versus this can turn into a violent situation.
Yeah.
Just never knew when it was going to slip over, right?
Yeah. My understanding is that, Nate, you left the church before the notorious pickets began. So during those earlier years, what was the focus of the church's teachings?
Well, it was very similar to what it is today. I would say that some of the ideas that they hold more firmly today have been refined, but fundamentally the message and the teaching is identical to what I grew up with. A lot of the language that you hear my siblings using on the picket lines, it's, you know, they're parroting my father. It's stuff that I heard 30 years ago.
Do you remember when you said, I can't take this anymore, I got to get away from here?
Well, I know that I felt that way for a very long time going into my teenage years, but it never occurred to me that the possibility existed because none of my siblings had managed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I watched my oldest sister try when she was 17, and he literally physically pulled her back home, and the rest of the time that she was there before she turned 18, there was a lot of violence. So as much as you wanted it, it wasn't necessarily considered seriously. And then my older brother, Mark, left. Mm-hmm. I was, I think, nearly 16 years old when that happened. And that was when the idea kind of coalesced and solidified in my mind that, yeah, I can do this.
What happened between when you left home and how you became an activist?
I left believing everything that my father taught me. So I left believing that I was going to die probably around the year 2000 when Christ returned, and I was going to go to hell.
Yeah,
that was the mindset that I had when I left. I just had to get out of there because of the violence. I avoided religion and the church like the plague for about 5 years. And then I met a gal, and we ended up getting married and started having kids. That's when I started returning to a church and joined an evangelical free church. But in throughout that entire process, I was still asking a lot of questions. A lot of it didn't make sense to me. It wasn't solving my life issues. And then I started deliberately challenging the leaders of the church in the area that I was living in Southern California. And ended up going through a divorce, and I moved to Canada, and finally in 2004, I think, was the first time I ever actually read something about the question of religion that hadn't been written by a Christian. Mm-hmm. It hadn't been written specifically to bolster that that idea, right?
Yeah.
That's when I started going down the path of questioning it all and how do they say, losing my religion.
When did you get rid of the fear? Or have you?
When I let go of the idea of God is when the burden fell off.
Yeah.
And it has been a dramatic experience in the last, I'd say, 7 years. It hasn't been a slow process like so much of the path that I was on.
Yeah.
It's suddenly, there's tremendous relief and a strong movement towards more joy in my life because I'm confident now of the nature of the world. And there's nothing to fear anymore.
Nate Phelps, my friends, was raised in the Westboro Baptist Church that was started by his late father, the Reverend Fred Phelps, Sr. The Kickstarter campaign is underway to make a documentary of his experience and of that experience in the church. Nate, I really appreciate your honesty, your candor, and I think that the interview itself will be of benefit to a lot of people because a lot of people have been hurt by religion. And thank you for talking about it.
Appreciate the opportunity, sir.
In the past couple of weeks, the respected Public Religion Research Institute has come out with two major new studies of American beliefs and attitudes on crucial contemporary issues. There are plenty of surprises to be found on both immigration and religious liberty. Here to highlight some of the key findings is PRRI's founding CEO, Dr. Robert P. Jones. Robbie, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thanks, Welton. Glad to be here.
Let's start with the immigration survey. You made headlines with the 62% support for a pathway to citizenship.
We've been polling on this all year long. So we've done four different surveys tracking Americans' attitudes on immigration reform. You know, as the prospects for legislative action have gone up and down and, you know, down again. And, you know, what we found is that the public opinions remain remarkably steady on this issue. In fact, in polling circles, you very rarely see issues where there is this kind of stability over this kind of time. So last year, a year ago, 63% of Americans said they supported a path to citizenship for immigrants who are in the country illegally, and today 62%. Those numbers aren't statistically different. So just rock steady support for path to citizenship over the last year.
So what were the other noteworthy numbers?
There is very broad cross-partisan and cross-religious support. So we found majorities of Republicans, 51%, it's a slim majority, but still a majority of Republicans support a path to citizenship, majorities of Democrats, and majorities of nearly every religious group, with one exception, white evangelical Protestants, also support a path to citizenship.
Can you explain that?
White evangelical Protestants are the religious group in the country that is the most Republican. So that's one thing going on. So even a year ago, they were the group that had the lowest support for immigration reform, although they were at 56% support a year ago, and it slipped a bit over this past year, down now below majority support. But it's important to note a couple things here, is that our immigration policy question had three parts. So the first part was, do you support allowing immigrants in the country illegally to become citizens, provided they meet certain requirements, or allowing them a way to become permanent legal residents, but not citizens, or do you favor identifying and deporting them? Mm-hmm. And what's important to say is that even though it slipped below majority support, a path to citizenship is still the preferred option. More evangelicals pick that option than pick the other two. Hmm. So we still have almost half saying path to citizenship. And we saw no uptick among evangelicals in support for deportation. So what we basically saw is a shift from support for path to citizenship to support for permanent legal resident status, mm-hmm. but not an uptick in support for deportation. When we look at other related issues, mm-hmm. for example, Americans' attitudes toward immigrants themselves, there we have seen an uptick in more positive evaluations of mm-hmm. the contributions of immigrants to the country, both in terms of kind of cultural contributions and in terms of economic contributions. The one that we have the longest trend on, we have a four-year trend on a question that asked Americans whether they think the growing number of newcomers from other countries either strengthens American society or threatens American customs and values. Hmm. And as recently as 2010, the country was evenly divided. 44% said newcomers from other countries mostly strengthens American society. 44% said threatens traditional American customs and values. Today, that number is very different. We have 58%, nearly 6 in 10, saying that newcomers strengthen American society. So a much more positive view of immigrants across this time period. Democrats are certainly more positive in their views of immigrants, but we've seen the attitudes of both Democrats and Republicans ticking up together, okay. right? So the change has been relatively stable across groups across this time.
Robbie, are there any other demographic variances that you find significant?
You know, there's some regional differences, the impact in the South, particularly of newer waves of immigrants, where we see, I think, heightened concerns. But the regional differences aren't quite as big as we might think. One other thing I would say, though, that unites Americans, in addition to their support for a path to citizenship, is in their belief that the immigration system we have is either mostly or completely broken. So we have 6 in 10 in the country saying that the immigration system is mostly or completely broken. And that includes 2/3 of Republicans who say this as well.
Hmm. Well, my final question on this particular survey, tell me about the Fox factor.
Right. We had a question about people's media consumption. And a couple of things that we found is, first of all, about a quarter of the country says that Fox News is the television news network that they trust most to give them accurate news about politics and current events. We found a couple of things to be true, though, is that those who watch Fox News are significantly less likely to support comprehensive immigration reform that includes a path to citizenship than are people who trust any other network in the country. And that remains true even if we control for a whole variety of demographic factors. So if we control for people's age and their gender and their party affiliation, even controlling for all of those factors and holding all of those constant, those who most trust Fox News, that turns out to be an independent predictor of their views on a path to citizenship in a negative direction. So it's a pretty remarkable and robust influence. And it turns out that among both Republicans and independents, it affects their views by about 20 points. So those who most trust Fox News are about 20 percentage points less likely to support immigration reform than those who most trust any other television news network.
My goodness, that's stunning.
It is stunning. And the other thing to say is that there's nothing like that on the left. There's no news network that really structures liberals or Democrats' opinions in the way that Fox News sort of dominates on the conservative side of politics.
And I guess you didn't do any polling on State of Belief Radio, but that's okay.
We did not.
You can find the Public Religion Research Institute's new survey, What Americans Want from Immigration Reform 2014, produced in partnership with the Brookings Institution, online at publicreligion.org. While we continue to wait for the Supreme Court to rule on the Hobby Lobby Conestoga Wood contraception mandate case, many other cases challenging this component of the Affordable Care Act continue to work their way through our legal system. We've talked a lot about the politics and the principles in play there, but what about public opinion? Well, fortunately, Dr. Robert P. Jones is ready to talk about their latest religion and politics tracking survey. What's the bold-faced headline on this survey?
Nearly 6 in 10 Americans think that privately owned corporations such as Hobby Lobby should be required to provide their employees with health care plans that cover contraception or birth control at no cost. That includes majorities of every religious group in the country, so Catholics included, with the one exception of white evangelical Protestants.
My goodness. Is there a point of reference, Robbie, from the past few years to help us evaluate those numbers over time?
About a year ago, we found very, very similar results. You know, in fact, in the general population, we asked about 6 different kinds of employers, 3 that were kind of religiously affiliated employers and 3 that were more secular, non-religious employers. And really, there's in the general public, only churches and other places of worship stand out as an organization that Americans as a whole think should be exempt from the ACA contraception mandate, which indeed they are under its guidelines. But every other kind of employer, including religiously affiliated colleges, religiously affiliated hospitals, privately owned small businesses, privately owned corporations, and publicly held corporations, among all of those other groups, majorities of Americans say they should be required to provide their employees with these health care plans that cover contraception.
And how did various populations break out in terms of their position on the birth control coverage mandate?
All these numbers I'm about to give are about specifically the Hobby Lobby category of privately owned corporations. So within that category, we have 57% of the public, but we have big partisan divides on the question. So 74% of Democrats say privately owned corporations should be required to provide their employees with contraception coverage, but only 33% of Republicans, right? So this is a big, big 40-point partisan gap here, but there's not a big racial divide on the question. There's interestingly not a big gender divide on the question. Majorities of Americans living in all 4 basic regions of the country favor this policy. Among age groups, there's not a big divide either. The only group actually falling below majority are seniors, presumably among whom this is not a big issue.
I'm curious if people had any trouble understanding the religious exemption itself.
Well, you know, we didn't get too far down into the weeds of what exactly it covered. But I would say that one thing we see from the data is that Americans as a whole still understand churches and other organizations, synagogues, mosques, other organizations that are principally religious institutions to be in a separate category from pretty much all other kinds of organizations. Only 42% say churches should be required to provide these plans, but 52% say religious affiliated colleges should, 56% say religiously affiliated hospitals should. So one big picture takeaway is that Americans still think of churches, synagogues, and mosques in a different category from other kinds of institutions in the country.
You do report a significant increase in the percentage of Americans who say religious liberty is being threatened in this country. What are the threats as they see them?
54% of Americans say the right of religious liberty is being threatened in America today, and that's how we worded the question. But what we see are, again, are really big partisan divides here. So 8 in 10 Republicans, that's twice as many as Democrats, only 40% of Democrats say that religious liberty is under attack today. Most Democrats disagree with that assessment. Independents are basically divided on this question. And again, we see also white evangelical Protestants as kind of an outlier here. So more than 8 in 10 white evangelical Protestants express this view, but only 55% of Catholics do, for example.
But Robbie, how do you reconcile that statistic with the answers that you got when you ask about specific issues? I mean, how much of that threat do you think is coming from just the indiscriminate use of the term religious liberty in today's culture wars as opposed to actual experiences?
That's a great question. And we have a little bit of evidence to go straight to this in the poll. Even though we saw an uptick in Americans' perceptions that in general, the right of religious liberty is being threatened today, that had no effect on their views on the contraception controversy that we've been talking about. So if these two things were tightly linked in Americans' minds, you would expect as their concerns about religious liberty would go up, their support for the contraception mandate would go down.
Right.
But we don't see anything like that correlation. So while I think some of the rhetoric by some religious leaders over the last year and a little bit more have maybe ratcheted up Americans' just general perceptions about religious liberty being under threat, they have not tied them to things like the contraception mandate.
Right, right. You even included a prayer at public meetings in this survey. What'd you find on that?
There, we found a kind of remarkable 8 in 10 Americans support allowing public officials to open meetings, such as town hall meetings, with prayer. Only 20% express opposition to that. And one notable thing here is that even a majority, nearly 6 in 10, religiously unaffiliated Americans supported allowing public officials to open meetings with a prayer.
Oh, my gosh. Well, what stood out for you as most surprising from among the answers you got?
We also asked about whether Americans thought that small business owners should be able to refuse service to different kinds of groups on religious grounds. So, you know, Jim Crow was really supported by many on religious grounds, right? Mm-hmm. There were religious arguments for keeping the races separate. So people would back up their refusal to serve African Americans at lunch counters with this kind of religious belief. And, you know, we found that fewer than 1 in 5 Americans say small business owners should be able to refuse services to those who happen to be gay or lesbians. 16% are atheists, 15% Jewish, 12% are black, 10%. Now, you can read that a couple of ways. So on the one way you can read it is to say, all right, well, to take the African-American number, you know, 90% of the country says that they don't think you should be able to refuse service. On the other hand, you could say this may be a bit troubling that even this far out from Jim Crow, 1 in 10 Americans still believes that small business owners should be able to refuse to serve African Americans based on their own religious views.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Robert P. Jones is CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. PRRI has just released the wide-ranging Religion and Politics Tracking Survey. You can read it online at publicreligion.org. Robbie, thank you for taking the time to join us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wellness. It's an honor to be here.
Peter Montgomery is a good friend, a senior fellow at People for the American Way, and an associate editor at Religion Dispatches. He's a remarkably good-natured fellow, considering how much time he spends tracking the extremist religious right. And so I'm always happy to welcome him to State of Belief Radio. Peter, welcome.
Thanks. I always enjoy being here.
Last weekend, the Texas GOP held their annual convention. Is there any real-world significance to the removal of some overt anti-gay language from the state party platform when other such language still exists, and especially when a wholehearted endorsement of so-called reparative therapy got added?
Yeah, no, I think they took out a little bit of rhetoric that said that homosexuality was tearing at the fabric of our society, and it's good that that's gone. But the more important part of the platform that's talking about policy still insisted on legal discrimination against gay people and same-sex couples, so you still have that discrimination language.
Yeah.
Then you add this endorsement of so-called ex-gay therapy or reparative therapy to fix gay people, which has been disavowed by every major reputable medical association.
Yeah.
And then plus there's a little bit in there about court stripping too, where they would try to deny the federal courts the rights to rule on these marriage cases.
Yeah. Some derisively call so-called cures for homosexuality pray away the gay. This stuff is purely based on conservative religious dogma, isn't it?
It is. And sometimes they try to dress it up a little bit as if it's some kind of scientific therapy. But the fact is, every medical association, the psychological association, the psychiatric association, they've all disavowed it. So that's really why it's left in the realm of religious right activists and religious right conferences promoting this stuff. And in Texas, that's also the GOP.
Yeah. Does anybody ever have another idea? Does anybody ever disagree?
Well, I think there was effort by some gay Republicans to resist some of this language and get it out, but they were, of course, shot down.
Yeah.
The way that people who wanted a more moderate language on immigration were shot down
Is the Texas GOP pandering to the religious right, or is it being run by the religious right?
Oh, it's definitely being run by the religious right. At this point, there's no pandering involved. I mean, we really are seeing the Ted Cruzification completed of the Republican Party. You know, he was kind of an outsider when he came into the party not very long ago, and now the party has become his. And, of course, he's hoping to make that true on the national level.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that what happened in Texas last week has implications in other states and on the national platform heading into the midterm elections?
I think there's no way it can't have some kind of influence. It certainly energizes the Tea Party folks. It energizes the religious right leaders by having a big victory. And, you know, after the 2012 Republican convention, there were some very brave Republican gay activists saying, oh, well, this is the last time we're ever going to have anti-gay language in our platform. And I thought at the time they were being optimistic, verging on delusional. I think what we saw in Texas is more likely a sign of what's to come.
Who are the leaders of the Texas GOP?
One of them is David Barton, who you yep. certainly know as this promoter of bogus Christian nation history. He, for many years, was an official in the Texas GOP. He's still very influential. He was influential in writing the national platform right. in 2012, and so yeah. he's still active in Texas. We have Kathy Adams, who used to be the chair of the state party and who now heads Eagle Forum there. She was also very active in all these platform deliberations. She is actually the person who introduced the reparative therapy platform. That came straight from Eagle Forum mm-hmm. and the religious right. So Eagle Forum actually had its banquet in conjunction with the Republican convention. And so there's a lot of pictures there of Ted Cruz with David Barton and Tom DeLay. And so it's really, you know, a lot of that national leadership of the religious right comes out of Texas.
What else are we going to need to keep an eye on in terms of anti-science, conservative, Christian-driven political agendas?
Well, some of that was also in the platform. Certainly the climate change denial was in the platform. Efforts to oppose textbooks that go down the road that the religious right doesn't buy into. So I think the science on sexuality, the science on reproductive choice, mm-hmm. the science mm-hmm. on climate, anything yeah. else that they don't agree with, basically.
People are listening to us, and I know this kind of conversation disturbs them. What in the world can we do about this? How do you answer the question?
Well, there's a lot of pieces to that. One is, you know, supporting organizations like yours and mine that do work on this, but a lot of it is really getting involved. I mean, one of the dispiriting things about Robbie Jones' poll was how many people are not intending to vote this fall because they're dispirited, because they're disappointed in Barack Obama. The number of people under 30 planning to vote was something like 24%. I mean, that's just brutal.
Yeah.
And the Tea Party is really energized. They've got another big scalp to hang on the wall now that they knocked out Eric Cantor. Mm-hmm. So they are going to be very energized. And it's really a task for the entire progressive movement to convince young people and progressive people and folks who don't share the vision of the religious right to do something about it, to get involved, because otherwise – they're excited and they're involved and they'll yeah. do things like we just saw in Texas.
When you look at the religious right today compared with the religious right when we first started following it, how do you compare where the religious right is now, not just in Texas, but all over?
Well, when it started, it was more of an outsider movement.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now the Republican Party
yeah.
in a lot of places in the country, not everywhere, but in much of the country. And that's certainly reflected if you look at the Republican caucus in Congress, which is now, once Eric Cantor is gone, 100% Christian.
Yeah.
But it's also just much more in control of a lot of the party apparatus, a lot mm-hmm. of the elected officials at local and state and national level.
Yeah.
The power is much more institutionalized. The Moral Majority had its heyday in the 80s and the Christian Coalition in the 90s. There's really a huge infrastructure. So there's not any one group that stumbles or one leader that stumbles. It's not going to derail the movement. You know, they've got a network of law schools that's cranking out lawyers and people who go take internships in White House and in congressional offices. It's got think tanks in every state of the country. So they don't go anywhere. And the Tea Party and the religious right are not entirely separate things. As some people want to see them, there's a tremendous amount of overlap, and the Tea Party kind of just puts a stronger anti-government, anti-tax focus on the right-wing agenda. But Ted Cruz is a great example of someone who really embodies both movements. And there's a big effort from the Heritage Foundation and a lot of other strategists like Ralph Reed to continue to merge the energies of those two movements, particularly when it comes to putting people in office.
Is there any one thing that bothers you about where we are right now more than any other?
The willingness of some of the far right to talk in rhetoric that is violent, that talks about maybe the need for revolution, that really pushes this notion that, you know, Barack Obama is not just a president that they disagree with, but that he's a tyrant. You know, there's pushing this thing out there that now that he may try to do something to cancel the 2016 elections and stay in office. And it sounds ridiculous to us, but there are millions of people around the country being fed this stuff day after day after day. And so I think the amount of divisiveness that has been pushed by the far right and by people like Fox News just makes everything so toxic. It makes it very hard. So here's Eric Cantor, who is a very, very conservative congressional leader, but because he sometimes did make some compromises to govern, he got tossed out. I mean, that kind of shows the level of extremism of the party's base, and that's going to make any progress for this country pretty tough.
Peter Montgomery is associate editor at Religion Dispatches and a senior fellow at People for the American Way. Peter, thanks for coming in. It's always fun to sit down talk.
Thank you.
Now, before we go, I want to tell you a question I've been thinking about. What does God have against Eric Cantor? Here's a small bit of unsolicited counsel for David Bratt, who pulled off the most surprising primary election upset in recent history when he defeated the majority leader of the House of Representatives, the second most powerful Republican in Washington, D.C., this past week. Recent history provides a cautionary warning about candidates citing God as a divine politician, summoning them to run for election and then assuring they will win their predestined position. During the 2011-2012 Republican presidential primaries, not a single one of the candidates who claimed a call from God to become the president of the United States won their party's nomination for the presidency. On the night of the election, Bratt, a Master of Divinity recipient from Princeton Theological Seminary, cited God as the cause of the miracle of his unexpected defeat of Eric Cantor. God working through people, Bratt said. How wonderful it would have been for Bratt to praise our democracy and talk about the power of a vote. But no, he had to place God's imprimatur on what happened in his congressional district. As political pundits spin their various theories of what happened in this primary election, I find myself musing over the question, what did God have against Eric Cantor? If Bratt was correct in his thinking, which I don't think was the case. Surely God wasn't upset over Cantor's support for immigration reform. Some polls indicated that 80% of the electorate in that congressional district of Virginia supported immigration reform. And theologically speaking, God identified welcoming the stranger as a hallmark of faith and love. And it wouldn't seem fair for God to punish Cantor for his support for pro-immigration reform in Virginia while rewarding Lindsey Graham for a similar position in South Carolina. Sadly, some hinted that Cantor's Jewish identity could have been a problem for the majority leader in the House of Representatives. God forbid. As far as I know, no anti-Semitic rhetoric or attitudes surfaced in either candidate's campaign. That phenomenon would classify as morally wrong and democratically evil. Let's just get rid of it right now. And on that note, I will end my hypothetical speculations. Here's the point about which I'm talking. Why can all of us not agree that what happened in Virginia had nothing to do with a sovereign imposition of theocratic politics, but simply was the consequence of voters who preferred Brandt over Cantor? That issue merits study, of course, but not the God talk themes. Is it not sufficient for us to trust the dynamics of our democracy? Why do some people have to attribute all political successes to God? I couple my unrequested counsel to candidate Brandt with a plea to all who are interested in the national congressional elections or any other election for that matter. Please don't use God as a political attribute, a tool for success, or the mascot for any political party. Our intermingling of personal faith and partisan politics is not helpful to anybody. My own hunch is that God would be pleased if no person or no political party tried to manipulate the divine for self-serving purposes. For all who believe in God and who want to talk about God's will, priorities, and actions, plenty of material cries out for attention. But it's not about partisan politics. It's about feeding hungry people, strengthening justice, caring for strangers, making peace, demonstrating love, and protecting freedom. Issues with a moral value established a long, long time ago. And just one more thing. You heard my conversation with the Reverend Allison Harrington, pastor of the Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona, as she spoke passionately about her congregation reviving a spirit of the 1980s sanctuary movement and welcoming one undocumented immigrant, Daniel, facing imminent deportation into their church building. Allison shared a memorable motto: better in trouble with the law than in trouble with the Lord. Well, it's likely that thus far, Southside Presbyterian has been able to avoid trouble with both. This week, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials granted a stay of enforcement, allowing Daniel to remain with his wife and American-born son, as well as to work here. I'll pause for just a second so you can try to guess what happens next. That's right. Allison and her church are already working on figuring out who they'll be able to offer sanctuary next. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support's essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and stay there while considering making a contribution, and don't get up until you do so. And do it today. We'll use the money wisely, I promise you that, to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear from listeners across the country who say they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that they can't find anywhere else. stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You can stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. Our listener line is 202-681-4246. You're welcome to call it anytime. We encourage you to tell others about the show. We want them in the conversation. We'll all be helped by more people joining us in the conversation. Encourage them to listen so they'll be ready for the dialogue. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was.